you, Randy. I'd like to spend a few minutes this morning talking about how the dry bean community has utilized genetic diversity to improve dry edible beans. I'd like to start out by mentioning that beans are really a horticultural crop, and there's consumer preference for specific seed types. And you can see up here in the diagram above, or the figure above, that's a sample of beans collected from just one market in Angola. So you find that there's preferences among countries and preferences within countries for specific seed types. In addition, for those of us who work in the tropics, we know that beans are grown in a wide or different number of cultural practices, and they're planted at different planting dates and with a wide range of technology. And all these factors tend to limit the impact of individual dry edible bean programs. And when we think about high yields, quite often we think about the U.S., but there are high yielding systems in the other part of the world. And this is an example of pole beans that are grown in Eastern Africa and Rwanda. And if you have sufficient labor, you can produce very high yields from this type of a cropping system. In the U.S., there's regionalization of the production of specific market classes. For example, you see most navy and black bean production is conducted or planted in Michigan and North Dakota under rain-fed conditions. Pinto bean production is in North Dakota under rain-fed production, and in Nebraska and Colorado, and excuse me, Idaho under irrigated conditions. Also, the beans are grown obviously under monoculture. In recent years, there's more interest in the direct harvest of beans, and this has resulted in the development of more erect plant types. But this might provide opportunities for planting in more narrow row widths. And I think from the response of the growers, there's also more interest among the growers in herbicide tolerance. Another characteristic of the dry bean is it tends to have a relatively short growing season, and as a result it tends to have a reputation of being among the legumes, one of the lower yielding crops. But if you look at the accumulation and partitioning of dry matter into yield, I think we'll find that it is as efficient as other grain legumes such as the soybeans. So one of the strategies that might be used for specific environments would be to develop cultivars that could be planted earlier in the growing season or extend it so we could harvest a little later in the growing season. And this is some data that comes from northeastern Michigan for soybeans and bean trials that were planted in 2008 and 2009. These are the five highest yielding lines in each of the trials. And you see in 2008, if you look at the accumulation of yield per day, that the dry beans, the navy beans in this case, and the soybeans have similar rates of yield accumulation. And in fact, in 2009, that the rates of yield accumulation were actually higher in the navy beans and the soybeans. The big difference in this environment is that the days to maturity of the navy beans is 30 days shorter than the soybeans. So we're really not taking advantage of the daylight rainfall of the full growing season. So one opportunity, perhaps in areas such as North Dakota and in Michigan, would be to stratify the environments and have different maturity zones. In soybeans, there's four different maturity zones where you could develop more full season varieties for some specific areas. And if you look at some specific areas within Michigan, Sandusky, which is closer to the lake, and Cairo, which is more in the interior of Michigan, you can see there's a three-week difference in frost-free period, and also in North Dakota. If you go north of Fargo to Grafton, you compare that to Wahpeton, which is south of Fargo, there's also a three-week period in growing season. So this might be an opportunity to exploit specific environments to develop higher yielding beans, but this would require the development of beans for new environments and the use of new germplasm. There would be some advantages in addition to higher yield. The longer season material would have better opportunities for biological nitrogen fixation. Some potential disadvantages: there might be unanticipated problems with diseases or pests, such as white mold, or there might be problems with grower acceptance, because the growers quite often like to harvest their beans and then move on to other crops. But this is just a thought that occurred while I was preparing the presentation. Now, if you look at the trends in yields, and we recognize that this is not all due to genetic improvement, but you see during the 20-year period from 1988 to 2008, there's in Michigan on navy beans, there's been about a 400 kilo per hectare increase. And this is similar to what was reported in soybeans, which is about 20 kilos per hectare per year in an increase. And North Dakota, there's been a greater increase. You see in the beginning of the beans, it's a relatively new crop in the early 80s, but you see a much greater increase, about 700 kilos per hectare, an increase. And now the yields at North Dakota are comparable to bean yields in Michigan for navy beans. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with beans, the beans have a Middle American and Andean centers of domestication. And within each center of domestication, there are different races, which were originally identified by Dr. Singh. And I think I can speak on behalf of the bean community. They were very proud that you're a recipient of the International Award this year in the Crop Science Society. Within each of these centers of domestication, there's different races which have been identified based on their geographic origin, morphological traits, and more recently on molecular information. Within the Middle American center of domestication, which is Mexico and Central America, we have race Mesoamerica, which includes black beans and navy beans, the Durango race, which includes pinto and great northerns, Jalisco, which includes reds and pinks, and then there's a race Guatemala, which really doesn't have any commercial seed classes, but it is a source of some specific traits such as anthracnose resistance, which has been widely used. Within the Andean center of domestication, there's a Nueva Granada race, which includes the kidneys and determinate cranberry beans, where there's a race Chile, which includes fine indeterminate cranberry beans, and then there's a race Peru, which includes yellow Mayacoba beans, Canario beans, and the Nuna beans, which are the popping beans. I'd like to discuss an example, first, a couple of examples, how crosses between different races within a particular gene pool have been very successful in improving some specific seed types. The first is with Great Northern and Pinto beans. And about 30 years ago, it was recognized that Pinto and Great Northern beans needed both improved architectural traits and greater yield potential. And Jim Kelly at Michigan State University initiated a program where he attempted to introgress, improve architectural traits from navy beans and black beans, which belong to race Mesoamerica, and incorporate that into Gran Pinto and Great Northern beans. And he utilized four cycles of recurrent selection, utilized Puerto Rico as one of the winter nursery sites. He was able to select both seed type and architecture in the F2. And after four cycles of selection, this led to the release of the variety Sierra, which is the first Pinto, which had more rec seed plant type. And if you look at some of the more recent releases of Pinto and Great Northern beans, such as Santa Fe, which Jim released, it's a Pinto bean Stampede, which Juan Manuel Osorno released, it's a Pinto bean, and Coin, which was released by Carlos Urrea in Nebraska, Great Northern. All of these trace their ancestry back to this initial effort to improve the architecture by Jim Kelly. And if you look at the trends in Pinto bean yields, this is in Nebraska under irrigated conditions, you see there's been about a difference of 600 kilos per hectare over this 20-year period. And a similar trend in North Dakota is about a 600 kilos per hectare increase in North Dakota, and this is under largely dry land conditions. Another example I'd like to do to discuss of the utilization of crosses between races within the gene pool is our work in Central America. In Central America, we've been able to combine genes from the Durango race and the Mesoamerica race to develop germplasm that has high levels of resistance to become a golden yellow mosaic virus. And when we're able to combine this virus resistance with heat tolerance and increased use of fertilizer, in countries such as El Salvador, there's been significant increases in seed yield. And you can see this is the trends over a 20-year period in El Salvador, and they've been able to increase seed yield from around 800 kilos per hectare to over 1,000. They're the first country in Central America to have mean yields over 1,000 kilos per hectare. Amadeo 77 is one of the most widely grown small red bean varieties. This is a variety developed and released by Juan Carlos Rosas at Zamorano in Honduras. If we look at the pedigree of this material, both Amadeos and Carizalito are sister lines, and it has Tio Canela as one parent, and Dicta 105 as another parent. Dicta 105 was derived from two APN lines. These are materials from CIA, which derive their resistance to the Mexican pod weevil from the race Durango. And Tio Canela is a cross between, once again, two Seat lines, the Door 483 and Door 391, and Pompadour J, which is an indeterminate red mottled line. It's a land race collected from the Dominican Republic. And it's a result of integration between Andean and Middle American gene pools. So here's one of the most successful bean varieties in Central America, which has a very diverse genetic background. I'd like to mention an effort in Puerto Rico. It's very important. Photoperiod sensitivity certainly limits the ability to evaluate tropical germplasm in the U.S. And Tim Porch, a colleague at the Tropical Agriculture Research Station, has a program of conversion similar to a sorghum to utilize back crossing to convert tropical bean germplasm from some of the underutilized races, such as Jalisco, Guatemala, Chile, and Peru. So this is a very important contribution to the bean research community. Also, crosses can be made between the Middle American and Andean gene pools. This is sometimes problematic. There are complementary dominant genes, which were discovered by Dr. Singh. The DL1, which is present in Middle American germplasm, DL2, when these complementary dominant genes are present, we can have problems with F1 lethality, although there are bridge genotypes that can be used to successfully make crosses. But quite often, it's very difficult to recover superiority progeny from crosses between gene pools. And part of the problem is that the Andean beans and the Middle American beans tend to offer to differ in seed size, growth habit, and days to maturity. And as a result, these contrasting types possess different combinations of morphological traits, phenological traits, in order to achieve yield. So in general, quite often crosses between the gene pools result in very poor combining ability. But if we look at specific disease genes, I think we can cite a couple of examples where working with specific genes, we can utilize crosses between gene pools to develop superior germplasm. It's been recognized that if we are able to combine or pyramid genes from different gene pools, we can achieve a much more durable and broader resistance to a number of different diseases, such as rust, anthracnose, and angular leaf spot. And I'm going to describe rust as one of the achievements. There's been a cooperative effort among a number of the different breeding programs. It was initiated by Rennie Stavely at the USDA station in Beltsville. It's continued by Talo Pastor Corrales, and this is done in cooperation with Michigan State and North Dakota, and they've been working together to develop our pyramid genes for rust. And I think the Belt DACME RMR19 is a very good example. You'll notice that it combines four specific genes to different genes for rust resistance. The UR3 is derived from race Mesoamerica. UR4 is an Andean gene. UR6 is a Drangosaurus, and UR11 is from a black bean, so it's race Mesoamerica. So it's a very diverse background, and when you combine these four genes, you'll note that it has resistance to all 90 races that are maintained by Dr. Pastor Corrales at Beltsville. Now, one of the general constraints that we have for those of us who work with larger seeded determinate Andean types is lower or more erratic yields than the indeterminate Middle American beans. And unfortunately, Jim Kelly's not here, so I won't get in too much trouble. But this is the trend in yield for dark red kidney beans over the last 20 years in the state of Michigan. But I don't want to pick on Michigan, because if we look at the trends for kidney beans probably in Minnesota, or if we look at Ecuador, we'll see similar trends, a very erratic yield and not much gain in progress in seed yield. So one of our long-term objectives at the University of Puerto Rico has tried to introgress more erect indeterminate growth habit from the Middle American gene pool from race Mesoamerica into Andean beans. And we've made some modest progress. Last year we released Badillo, which is the first release of an indeterminate light red kidney bean, which stands quite well. And it's a result, if you follow its pedigree far enough back, this is its indeterminacy and erectness is derived from DOR 303, which is a line from SEAT, and its parents include Porillo Sintetico, as you can see, which is a black bean from Mexico. So this is an example where an Andean Middle American cross has been used to develop an improved bean cultivar of the Andean. And we've done, and this is an example, the seed yield of a trial we conducted. Mount Calm and Red Hawk are determinate varieties that are commonly produced. This is conducted in Isabela, Puerto Rico. But you can see that the Badillo produced significantly higher yields than the determinate lines. We've also done this with red mottled lines, developed more erect indeterminate types. And we released with Matthew Blair at SEAT and our colleagues in the Dominican Republic and Haiti this breeding line in 9745-232, which is also high yielding and resistant to bean gold and yellow mosaic virus. And this line recently topped the trials in Angola, Haiti, and our yield trials in Puerto Rico. So it has a lot of potential. I should also mention wild beans. They're distributed all the way from Mexico down to northeastern Argentina, and they grow in a wide range of conditions, so they have a number of traits which are of potential value to breeding programs. And we do recognize in the bean community that the best domestication syndrome and varietal development activities have greatly reduced or narrowed our genetic base. So there's great interest in utilizing wild beans to improve the crop. And both back cross, inbred back cross, and a number of different approaches have been used to integrate traits from wild beans into the common beans. And I think one of the most striking examples is some work that was conducted by Jim Kelly. This is a cross between Negro Tacaná and G24423, a wild bean. And this is an inbred back cross population. And when he tested this in 2004, he was able to achieve a record yield in replicated trials of almost 5,800 kilos per hectare, which is 27% higher than the recurrent parent Negro Tacaná. So this is a good example of how the wild beans might be able to be used to improve yield. And recently he has in press a manuscript which identifies a major QTL from this population, which is on linkage group B10. Matthew Blair at SEAT has also worked with Andean wild beans and some crosses, and he has also identified a QTL for seed yield. There are a number of other specific traits from wild beans that have been used that have potential value. This includes arsenin for brucid resistance, and we've used wild beans for our improvement of web blight resistance in Puerto Rico. I'd like to also mention that there's been collections. Jim Stedman, a colleague at Nebraska, and one of his students had made collections in Central America, and they found that some of the collections near the center of diversity of the pathogen are also very good sources of resistance to the disease. In terms of different species of Phaseolus, there are five or four. Yesterday we heard there are four. Depends off if you're a split or a lumper. But the common bean can be crossed with three of the four with different degrees of difficulty. I think one of the most striking examples of the utilization of interspecific crosses has been with common bacterial blight. And in general, there's only moderate levels of resistance to common bacterial blight in common bean. So there's been an effort to utilize interspecific cross utilizing both the tepary bean, the acutifolius, and the scarlet runner bean, the coccineus, to develop germplasm with enhanced levels of resistance. And there are really two groups. One group, Dr. Singh at CIOT, he's now at University of Idaho, worked with interspecific crosses with the tepary bean, and this effort resulted in the release of lines VAX1 to VAX6, which have very high levels of resistance to common bacterial blight. And there was another group led by Mildred Zapata and George Freitag in Puerto Rico in collaboration with Dr. Wilkinson from Cornell. And they were working with interspecific crosses with coccineas. And this also led to a number of breeding lines which had resistance to common bacterial blight. And this is an example of the utilization of the material. This ZAN 159 is an interspecific cross, and this was used, an interspecific line, and this has been used to develop ABC Wang at Nebraska, which has high levels of resistance. And more recently, we have utilized or released Verano, which you'll note has both WBB, which has 20-1, which has a coccineous source of resistance, and VAC6, which is a tepary source of resistance. And here's just a number of other additional traits found in tepary beans, which might be of interest. These include disease, pest resistance, and abiotic stress tolerance. These are some traits that have been identified in the scarlet runner bean. In fact, there were two presentations, one poster and one presentation on white mold resistance at this meeting. Once again, for a number of disease and abiotic stress tolerance. I'd like to end mentioning a couple initiatives I think will be very useful in the future for utilizing genetic diversity. This includes the bean cap led by Phil McLean at NDSU. And they're developing a genome, a map for the common bean genome. And so hopefully we'll have a SNP-based map in the near future. Another is an NSF project led by Eduardo Vallejos at the University of Florida, where hopefully they're going to incorporate some of this genomic information into the crop model. So we'll have a better understanding of genotype by environment interaction. I'd like to end by mentioning that there's a number of factors that have contributed to the exchange and utilization of gene germplasm. This includes a very active regional hatch project, a dry grain pulse crisp project, which provides an opportunity to visit the tropics. And we also have a bean improvement cooperative, which publishes every year, and we have biannual meetings. And as public breeders, I think there's a more free exchange of germplasm among the breeding programs. Also, collaboration with CIOT, both their research program and their germplasm unit, has been very useful. And also the National Plant Germplasm System has been very useful in providing access to material. That's all I have. Thank you for your attention. Yeah.